Session number 12288 through 02.
Mr. Brathwaite, Shreel Toe.
Right, I remember one of the flight commanders was a squadron leader, Webster, Sandy Webster, and he had done a tour on Hampdens in England. The other flight commander was a squadron leader, Webster. Flight commanders and Webster, who also had done a tour in England on Blenheims, I think. Apart from that, there wasn't a great deal of operational experience among the pilots.
What was morale in the squadron like when you joined it?
Very good. Being young and sort of flying out to India and seeing life there, you know, it's all exciting and very good. I never knew a time when morale wasn't good, actually. It was always basically good.
How did they feel about having these inferior aircraft?
Well, a bit of a joke, really. Nothing serious. They were much slower than the original version. For one reason, they had to have extra air intake and oil intake filters fitted, which slowed them down, and they were old, and the weather was very hot. They were unserviceable for probably more than those in England because of the age of the aircraft and the weather conditions, I think.
At this time, the political movement in India, the Congress Party, had launched the Quit India movement. Did you have any connection with civil disturbances? Did you see anything of that?
Yes, from Asansol. At one time, the civil disobedience campaign was concentrated on the railways. They used to burn down signal boxes and overnight they'd disconnect lengths of railway line and turn it over with elephants, so that the whole length of line was turned over with the sleepers. And during that time, we were flying patrols up and down the railway and reporting any concentrations of people or any damage to signal boxes. And we had instructions to what we used to call beat them up, fly low overhead and fire our guns over their heads. Definite instructions not to fire into the crowd. We shared Asansol with 113 Squadron, and one of their crew force landed near a riot in progress, and the crew were killed by the rioters.
How did you feel about that?
Well, you get a bit phlegmatic about these things, really. I don't think anybody thought very deeply about the political significance of the disobedience campaign. What we didn't know at the time, but found out later, of course, was that there was an Indian division serving with the Japanese, which I assume was based on the same thing, the objection to the British rule in India.
So the killing of the aircrew didn't upset you?
Well, it incensed everybody, certainly. I mean, you don't... that sort of thing doesn't happen, you just ignore it. But, I don't think that it sort of put anybody off or roused any particular feelings of vindictiveness.
How many times do you think you had to open fire over the heads of crowds?
Well, we opened fire a couple of times. We only did about half a dozen of these security patrols.
Do you think anybody was hit?
Oh, I don't think so. Not by us, anyway. I heard no reports of anybody being hit.
How low did you come?
Oh, right down to the ground. One of our chaps, Flight Lieutenant Muller Rowlands, he was a flying officer then, He hit his wing on a signal and took the wingtip off and came back with a wingtip missing, which was quite a good flying feat, airmanship.
Did the crowd scatter when you...
Sometimes, but they got a bit blasé towards the... like everything, once the worst has happened here, it's not bad anymore.
Did you have much to report when you made these patrols?
Oh, yes, we often saw gatherings around signal boxes and stations along the railways. Not very great gatherings, but a group of people.
Do you think that the work that you did was helpful in combating the agitation?
It's hard to say, really. It probably was, because a lot of the people rioting were peasants and were unused to that sort of treatment that they received from us. It might have dispersed them, I suppose.
Can you remember the places that you flew over in doing that?
Yes, I've got a couple noted down here. This was from Asansol.
This is from your logbook, Richard?
Yes, Parvatipur, Dinjapur, Katihar, Kursela, Kudia, back to base was one.
When were those flying?
That was in August of 42. And this, the same trip again in the following day. Another trip on the 18th.
Any notes that you've got down there?
Yes. Well, I've got here natives machine gun destroying rails, but that would be fired over the heads. It wouldn't be firing into them.
How long would your flights have lasted?
Four and a half hours.
How did you feel about doing this kind of work? Did you enjoy it, or did you feel that it was a unnecessary diversion from what you expected to be doing?
No, I don't think you questioned these things too deeply at that age. You did as you were told, and there was nothing objectionable about it. It was a bit of a diversion, but equally, of course, we had famines at the time, and on one occasion we gave our rice ration up to the local village who were starving, and our cooks cooked it and they wouldn't eat it. Because it had been handled by whites. The children ate it, but the adults wouldn't touch it.
Any other memories from serving in Asansol area?
Yes. It was very hot in the hot season. Well over 100, and it was very hot and sticky in the wet season, the monsoon season, and flying was very uncomfortable and very bumpy. Low level. We were quite away from the front at the time. I would imagine that was because of the problems, logistic problems of servicing petrol and bombs and that sort of thing. And most of our trips in the early days, we had to fly to an advanced landing ground to refuel, to extend our range, to get to the targets. And we used to go regularly to dirt strips cut out of the jungle. Agartala was one originally. And we used to go to Dum Dum, the Calcutta airport, to refuel. But at these air landing strips, they used to deliver us X number of 4-gallon petrol tins, which we cut open with our fire axe and topped up the tanks ourselves. And likewise, they would leave a trailer with 4 250-pound bombs on, and we had to load those ourselves. And then we would sling our mosquito nets under the wing of the aircraft and bed down for the night before taking off in the morning. In the early days, had quite an amusing incident. A native appeared out of a bush looking at us, and he had a basket on his head, and he had a pineapple in it, and we couldn't speak their language. And I said, have that. And he said, no, he wouldn't sell it to me. And he went off and he came back and, he said, 1 rupee. Well, rupee was, at that time, they were 13 to the pound, about 1 and sixpence. And we said, no, not for one pineapple a rupee, see? And he disappeared, and he came back with a basket on his head full of pineapples. He sold us about 30 pineapples for one rupee, which we put in the back of the aircraft and took back to base where, you know, fresh food was at a premium. And they smelt pretty strongly during the trip, I might say, a basket full of pineapples. But they insisted on silver rupees, not rupee notes.
So you were using Agatala and Dum Dum as forward refueling.
To refuel, to extend the range, you see, because at the time the fronts were quite a long way away from that. And we were attacking at the time dock installations and shipping and troop concentrations and railways, marshalling yards, sort of thing. Mostly low or lowish level, under 10,000 feet or at ground level.
Where were these targets?
Down the Burmese coast and down the Irrawaddy towns down there.
So this is the Arakan?
Yes, the Arakan. To start with, they were quite well defended. There was invariably anti-aircraft fire and fighter intrusion. We used to be escorted by Hurricanes and planes called Mohawks. They were an earlier radio version of the Kitty Hawk, which is probably more familiar. And they were better armed and armoured. More armour plating than the Japanese, but they weren't as fast and they weren't as manoeuvrable. But they did a good job. And then as the Japanese were pushed back in Burma, we moved first to Jessore, which was northeast of Calcutta, about 100 miles nearer the front, and then later to a place called Doazari, which was a dirt strip cut out of paddy fields. And we were quite close to the front line there, and we were often bombed and strafed by the Japanese there.
Could we look at your logbook to get some details about the individual operations?
Yes.
At this time, please.
August the 22nd, we went to Tezpur, T-E-Z-P-U-R, to bomb. That was a three-hour trip. Then I went to Mykonos, M-Y-I-T-K-Y-N-A, Mykonos it's called. Bombed the town there.
And what date was that?
That was August 26th.
Does it say anything about that operation?
Well, bombs observed, ACAC fire, four 250-pound general-purpose bombs. And about this time, we'd got a further advanced landing ground at Feni. That was just below Doazari.
That's on the
again near Chittagong. That's right, below Chittagong. Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's another one here, October the 5th, Yenengyang, Chittagong. A bomb troops billets. Hits observed. No anti-aircraft fire. And then October the 7th, Feni Akiab, a low-level attack on the harbour. Hits observed, anti-aircraft fire.
When was that?
That was October the 7th, the 3:35, that 3 hours 35 minutes. Then on October the 12th, we went to a place called Kalawa. We bombed troop billets. Bombs not observed, anti-aircraft fire. That was a four-hour trip. On the 20th of October, we went to Maniwa. We bombed troops, bullets there. Hits observed, no anti-aircraft fire. the 23rd of October. That was a 5-hour, 15 trip, that one. On the 23rd of October, we bombed Rathodong, troop bullets again. Observed hits, no anti-aircraft fire, then 5:35, that length of that trip. On the 26th of October, we went to Boothydong. We bombed troops in the town and strafe with machine gun fire. And bombs observed on the target, and it was 4 hours 25.
That's the Arakan coast again.
Still, yes, we see our range was fairly limited down there. It was either the the coast or the Irrawaddy, the towns down the Irrawaddy, because movement in Burma was restricted to the river valleys, really, because it's, if you look on the map, it's a series of mountain ranges running north-south, heavily forested, and the only way of making progress is down the river valleys. And on the 29th of October, 28th of October, offensive reconnaissance, Jasaur, Tilin, Gangor, Khan, Shimpi, Sarkta, Harka, to Dum Dum. Bomb Gangor, hits observed on the target. No time on that one. Oh, yes, it was 5 hours and 5 minutes. It was quite a long journey for a Blenheim, really, because they only had a range of 900 miles. Then in November, advanced landing ground, Paletois, Poneggyong, Rathodong, Boothydong, Tong Bazaar, Dum Dum, offensive reconnaissance, bomb river steamer, machine gun, smaller craft. 3 hours 14, that was. 13th November, Tilin, Ken, Shimpi, Harker base, offensive recce, 10/10 strato cumulus, over area, turned on DR position, unable to carry out recce, too much cloud about. Akiab, 22nd November, aerodrome bombed, 21 Hurricanes with escorts, hits on strip observed, heavy anti-aircraft fire, the 4-hour 55 job. On the 25th November, Mingyan, bombed railway junction at Mingyan, hits observed in target area, Noakak, Hurricane escort, that was 5 hours 20. December the 7th, Imphal, Mandalay, briefed a bomb rolling stock at Mandalay, 10/10 cloud obscured target, Hurricane escort. Of course, we had no sophisticated aids to navigation in India. It was all dead reckoning. The wireless was unreliable. We didn't have G or OBO or any of the things they had to enable bombing through cloud here. And of course, you don't go down low in cloud conditions because it's all mountainous, full of, you know, very mountainous. And
so by then you'd extended your range as far as Mandalay.
Yes, that was Magatala, in the advanced landing ground. And December the 12th, Agatala, Imphal, Mandalay. That was a repeat of the previous one. Rolling stock and installations bombed. It's observed on target, Hurricane escort, heavy anti-aircraft fire. December the 14th, Kyoktor, town bombed. Bombs observed off target. Oh, but not mention that one. Hurricane escort. December the 20th, Magway. Strip at Magway bombed. It's observed on target, Hurricane escort, heavy anti-aircraft fire. Lieutenant Wilkins shot down. He was one of the South Africans.
Do you remember how he was shot down?
Well, in formation, he suddenly burst into flame. He was hit by anti-aircraft fire at about 10,000 feet, that would be. I believe, actually, they bailed out because I heard later that he had been a POW, which wasn't any picnic, of course, there. December the 22nd, Magway. Brief to bomb runways. Formation returned due to insufficient fighter escort. January the 5th, rolling stock at Mandalay bombed. 6 hours, 10 minutes, that one. The 10th, Ong Dung, town bombed. It's observed in the towns. No anti-aircraft fire, Hurricane escort. 15th of Jan, Kyoktor. Ridge east of Kyoto or bombed, fighters escorted and strafed, no anti-aircraft fire. 15th of Jan, Mayu Peninsula. Pagoda at south tip of peninsula bombed. Near misses. Fighters strafed. 18th of Jan, Mayu. Brief to bomb district bungalow at tip of Mayu Peninsula. Aircraft filled with smoke at Chittagong returned to Feni satellite. Oh, must have been a moment of panic. 21st of January, Yegyambien, bomb town, good results, no opposition, hurricane escort. How much further?
Do I understand then that the that Japanese fighters didn't come up very much to oppose you?
Well, initially they did. But I think after a while the Pacific War hotted up and a lot of the Japanese fighters were withdrawn to that theatre, which was probably more important to them, protecting the homeland and keeping the empire they were trying to create.
Do you have any specific memories of Japanese fighters attacking you?
Oh, yes, yes. They often used to get attacked by them. They would sort of buzz around and come into the formation. And as a rule, they were distracted by the Hurricanes and Mohawks escorting and take them away from us.
What impression did you get of the skills of the Japanese pilots?
Well, I think you know, everybody thought they were pretty skillful because I think for the most part they didn't have a large wartime training scheme. They had a large peacetime air force with a large number of trained pilots, and we all got the impression that they were quite skilled flyers. Their aircraft didn't take damage very well. They broke up easily. Some of their fighter aircraft, they had a telescope sight. So when they attacked an enemy, they had to get their eye to a telescope, which restricted them. And one of the ploys, if you were attacked by fighters, was to get right down on the ground and weave among the trees, because the theory being that if a Japanese was lining up his telescope on you, he might well fail to see a tree and hit it.
Did that happen?
It's hard to say. Rumour has it that it did occasionally, but one doesn't know, really.
How did the Blenins perform it under these conditions?
They were very slow, quite well armoured. These Japanese pilots that we took to Biggin Hill said they didn't like Blenheims because they were hard to shoot down. They, you know, they used to hit them quite often, but with no apparent results. We carried armour plate protecting the gunner and the pilot.
These were Japanese pilots, we should say, that you met after the war?
Yes, the two we met at Biggin Hill. We took to Biggin Hill. But they were pretty reliable. We were rather lucky because most of our ground crew were peacetime, Halton-trained, skilled people, and they were the best, I think. They looked after us pretty well.
What about the weather conditions of the operational area?
Weather conditions were poor, really, because in the hot season, it was very hot, and getting into an aircraft, if you'd happened to leave your parachute in the seat, as we usually did, and hadn't turned the straps back and the buckle was exposed to the sun, it would burn you, literally, when it touched your skin. We quickly learned to get bamboo mats and put them over the canopy while the aircraft was standing on the ground to stop it getting so hot inside. Aircraft used to overheat very quickly in the hot weather. Taxiing, if you had to taxi any distance, you invariably were overheated by the time you came to take off. In the wet weather, we had months of continuous rain, torrential rain, and very often visibility was nil. You couldn't see through the rain on the windscreen, and water used to get in the engines and make them unreliable. You had a succession of heavy rain showers, then hot sun, and everything was steamy. Humidity was very high, and most people suffered from prickly heat, which is an inflammation of all the pores of your body. And it was agony to put a shirt on if you had prickly heat. But we had to wear long sleeve shirts and trousers for safety reasons in case of accident and fire. But it was some protection. Actually, conditions at Asansol when we got there were pretty atrocious because it was just a collection of new bamboo huts with no proper cooking facilities. Cooking was open trenches and bamboo wood to burn. There were no proper showers, no proper latrines, and illness was, the rate was quite high, dysentery and malaria and heat exhaustion and boils and all sorts of things. Things gradually improved, but it still remained fairly primitive. We were quite incensed when the Americans moved in a year after we did up the road and moved into a fully kitted out camp with oil-fired cookers and mesh-screened canteens and refrigerators and cold drinks and all that sort of thing, the usual American business. Well, I say incensed, so a bit of jealousy. But Asansol was primitive.
Were conditions at Jessar and Durazari any better?
Much the same, actually. Durazari, of course, was an advanced landing ground, and it was very primitive there. And we used to get bombed there quite a bit and strafed.
With much result?
Not really. We had shelters and with heavy tree trunks over them for protection. I think the worst I heard of was we got down a trench one day and we were bombed and the ground shook pretty heavily and the vibration loosened the earth between these trunks and released a load of ants onto the people in the trench. Well, those at the far end away from the opening were trying to get out. Those by the opening were trying to keep them in. So it was quite amusing.
So the Japanese didn't succeed in causing much disruption or casualties?
Not really, no. No. We had the aircraft in pens by then, the earth embankments to protect them.
How did you feel about going out on operations in Burma? Was it routine, or did you dread them, or what?
Oh, I didn't dread them, no. I think, quite honestly, at that age, nobody sort of really expected to live for any great length of time. It's very much a question of thinking about today, never thought too much about tomorrow.